Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, author Tina Fey discusses her new memoir, Bossy Pants, and her life as a comedian, actor, television producer, and mom. HBO's new fantasy series, Game of Thrones, takes the network into terrain far removed from its reputation for true-to-life, realistic programming. And NPR's Lynn Neary reports on the origins of a new collection of Dr. Seuss stories due out this fall. But first,
my guest Tina Fey has written a hilarious new memoir called Bossy Pants, in which she writes about her life before she became famous and tells great stories about being the head writer on Saturday Night Live, serving as the co-anchor of Weekend Update, creating and starring in her own TV series 30 Rock, and returning to Saturday Night Live to portray Sarah Palin. She also writes about being a daughter and a mother. Last year, Tina Fey became the youngest winner of the Kennedy Center's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Last month, at Comedy Central's first Comedy Awards ceremony, she won for Best Actress in a Comedy for her performance opposite Steve Carell in Date Night. She won two Golden Globe Awards for her performances on 30 Rock, and the show won a Golden Globe for Best Comedy Series. She's won a total of seven Emmys for writing, acting, and producing. Tina Fey, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is great to have you here. Your book is hysterical, so I'd like you to start by reading an excerpt from it, and I'd like you to read The Mother's Prayer for Its Daughter.
It would be my pleasure.
Thank you.
I will try to read it in what I imagine is the vocal style of Danielle Steele. The Mother's Prayer for Its Daughter. First, Lord, no tattoos. May neither the Chinese symbol for truth nor Winnie the Pooh holding the FSU logo stain her tender haunches. May she be beautiful but not damaged, for it's the damage that draws the creepy soccer coach's eye, not the beauty. When the crystal meth is offered, may she remember the parents who cut her grapes in half and stick with beer. Lead her away from acting, but not all the way to finance. Something where she can make her own hours, but still feel intellectually fulfilled and get outside sometimes and not have to wear high heels. What would that be, Lord? Architecture? Midwifery? Golf course design? I'm asking you, because if I knew, I'd be doing it, you damn it. May she play the drums to the fiery rhythm of her own heart with the sinewy strength of her own arms, so she need not lie with drummers. O Lord, break the internet forever, that she may be spared the misspelled invective of her peers and the online marketing campaign for Rape Hostel 5, Girls Just Want to Get Stabbed. And when she one day turns on me and calls me a bitch in front of Hollister, give me strength, Lord, to yank her directly into a cab in front of her friends, for I will not have that nonsense. I will not have it.
That's so funny. It's Tina Fey reading from her new book, which is called Bossy Pants. There's one story in your book that I so related to. Your mother made you try on a bra over your shirt at JCPenney's.
Yes.
And I don't know how many girls went through this kind of thing with their mother where you have to, like, try on clothes,
yeah,
not in the dressing room, but in the middle of
yeah,
in the middle of the store.
Sorry.
Where everybody's going to see you, and then the store manager, if there is one, is going to be really angry too. How horrible was that?
At the time, it was horrifying. And also, I developed very early, and was probably in, you know, fifth grade getting a bra. I say in the book that I developed breasts so early and so strangely high that it wasn't the bra was more to clarify what they were, that they were not a goiter or something. And it was mortifying, but in that same way that I can absolutely see making that same mistake of, because you're so used to, you transition as a mother at some point from literally just, you know, pulling a booger out of that person's nose whenever you see one, until at some point they assert to you, like, no, I'm a person. You can't, you know, fix my underpants on the subway.
I watched you accept the Mark Twain Comedy Award,
mm-hmm,
at the Kennedy Center, and your parents were in the audience. They looked so proud of you, in spite of the fact that you made a joke about preparing to send them to a home.
I did. They rolled with some jokes there.
Yeah. But were they proud of you when you decided to move to Chicago to study improv?
You know, they were very supportive, always. And
so that's a risky thing. They really were okay with that?
They were okay with it, yeah. And they never, you know, to their credit, they never said, like, you like entertainment? Are you sure you don't want to be an entertainment lawyer? Like that kind of depressing thing. They, you know, because my dad is a painter. And so I think he understood that part of me that wanted to pursue this. And also understanding, you know, wanting to pursue that before you have commitments, before you have a family. Mm-hmm. And I think they knew that we weren't, neither my brother or I would ever really end up, you know, coming back to them destitute. We always had jobs to, you know, pay for our classes or whatever, you know, whatever we were interested in.
So you worked at the Evanstown Y?
Yes, the Evanston. Illinois McGaw YMCA.
Yeah, and yeah. Then got a spot at Second City.
Yeah.
And, you know, you describe some of the rules of improv.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is, you know, make statements. Don't ask questions and put the onus on the other person mm-hmm. to come up with something. You come up with something, give it to them,
mm-hmm.
and then they have to react with something.
Exactly.
And you say that this applies to women, too. Speak in statements instead of apologetic questions.
Yes.
Were you ever in that category of speaking in apologetic questions and having to be more assertive, or speaking all the time in statements that sound like questions?
You know, oh, yeah. Hopefully I never really had that behavior, that kind of.
Exactly.
Once again, maybe a little on the old side. I think that became standard issue in the late 80s. I don't know. I mean, I'm a shy person. And so I definitely learned in those early improv classes to initiate and to step forward. And you learn so much in those classes because you also eventually, once you get better at improv, you learn, like, you know, when do you step forward? When do the great, you know, thing at an improv Olympic thing, I think, too, which is another improv theater there, you know, you ask, when you're teaching, you ask improvisers who have been a couple classes in, a couple sessions, whatever, you say, well, no, here's the question, when do you enter a scene? And people say, well, when you have an idea. No. When you enter a scene, when you think of something funny, say no. And the answer is, when do you enter a scene? Is when someone needs you. You're only to enter when someone needs you. And so if you're observing the scene and you feel it start to lull, or if someone in the scene refers to something that it would be beneficial to see. And so it's this great mindset of contributing, but as a group. It's not, you never just come in. I mean, people do, because you always make mistakes in the practice of it, but come in just because that scene looks fun and I want to be in it too, or I've got a great idea for a loud character that could enter this scene.
I want to play another clip. And you know how we were talking about that, you know, you say actresses shouldn't, like, speak in questions all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to make statements. So this is from an episode of 30 Rock called Sexy Baby. And this is like a new writer on the show.
Oh, yeah, the episode, the actual title of the episode is TGS Hates Women.
Oh, right, yeah. Because this writer's hired to kind of change things around because mm-hmm. the show's being accused of being misogynistic.
Mm-hmm.
So this new writer's hired, but she's a real sexy baby type.
Mm-hmm.
And you're trying to tell her to, like, act, like, knock it off. You don't
right.
have to put on that act when you're not acting. You know, mm-hmm. just, like, knock it off and be yourself. And so here's that scene.
Abby, thanks for meeting me here. This place is very special to me.
Is this where you got your V-card punched?
What? No. Does this look like the makeup room of a clown academy? No. This is a statue, and I know you know this, of Eleanor Roosevelt, first lady to the world, champion of the rights of women, and the lid on my high school lunchbox. Look, I know it can be hard. Society puts a lot of pressure on us to act a certain way, but TGS is a safe place, so you can drop the sexy baby act and lose the pigtails.
But I like my pigtails. My uncle says they're sexy.
Enough with the gross jokes and that voice. I want you to talk in your real voice.
This is my real voice. And the whole sexy baby thing isn't an act. I'm a very sexy baby. I can't help it if men are attracted to me. Like that homeless guy. He likes what he sees.
Okay, that could be for me.
It's not. It's for her.
Abby, I'm trying to help you.
Really? By judging me on my appearance and the way I talk? And what's the difference between me using my sexuality and you using those glasses to look smart?
I am smart. I placed out a freshman German.
Or Lutz using that sexy English accent to get me in the sack.
No, you didn't. Lutz? that even possible? I mean, I was there when he belvedered. God, Abby, you can't be that desperate for male attention.
You know what, Liz? I don't have to explain myself to you. My life is none of your business.
Except it is, because you represent my show and you represent my gender in this business and you embarrass me.
Kiss!
Dude, I am sorry, but this is who I am. Deal with it.
My guest Tina Fey with Kristen Milioti. Am I saying her name?
I think right. So, yeah.
In a scene from 30 Rock. Do you know actresses like that who, or writers like that who have that kind of like sexy baby persona?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because as we were listening to that, I was thinking like, yeah, it's just your typical sitcom 2-minute long discussion about gender. I'm like, what? No wonder no one wants to watch this program. Yeah, actually, I was remembering as we were listening to it that the thing about the moment, and this script was written by Ron Weiner, but I remember one of the things that we talked about this story a lot in the room, the moment where I say to her, talk in your real voice, is actually a thing that I remembered from a college acting class where there was a girl, this beautiful, really beautiful, voluptuous little tiny actress who had one of these tiny voices. And I had one of my acting teachers, I remember she was doing a monologue in class, and he very gently said to her, he's like, okay, I want you to do the monologue again, and I would like you to use your adult woman voice. And she did. And all the other women in the class I remember looking at each other like, I knew it. I knew that voice wasn't real. And that moment was kind of inspired by that, because sometimes those voices are real. Sometimes they are a habit that's just kind of worn in. But this episode was – that story is so kind of loaded and complex and that I was really glad that we did it. And I think it's confused and sort of delighted the internet in a way, because you – that it sort of opens up more questions than answers. I mean, for me, it was about – Liz is in the wrong to try. She thinks she's doing the right thing by trying to correct this woman, by trying to say, like, you don't have to be this way. And at the same time, this girl has every right to be whoever she wants. And so that to me was what the story was about, that it's just such a tangled up issue. The way women present themselves, whether or not they choose to, you know, as I say, put their thumbs in their panties on the cover of Maxim, and the way women judge each other back and forth for it, it's a complicated issue. And we didn't go much further saying anything about it other than to say, yeah, it's a complicated issue, and we're all kind of figuring it out.
Tina Fey, it's been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Tina Fey's new memoir is called Bossy Pants.
After our interview with Belva Davis, we asked her if she wanted to offer up a few songs for our segment, In Your Ear. That's when we ask guests what music they listen to when they need some inspiration, need to chill out, or when they need to work out. This is what she told us.
Miles Davis, Sketches of Spain. Captures all the beauty of the outdoors and all of the melody that Miles carried in that horn. John Coltrane, My Favorite Things. My husband proposed to me right after we heard that song. Ha 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 ha! Save Your Love for Me by Nancy Wilson.
Wish I knew. Why I'm so in love with you. No one else in this world will do. Darling, please save your love for me.
She's the reason why I'm married to the wonderful man I'm with today. 46 years of a happy marriage because of you, Nancy.
Run away. If I were wise, I'd run away. But like a fool in love, I stay.
That was journalist Belva Davis telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear this and past In Your Ear segments, go to our website, npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More.
I can feel it, even when.
Every now and then, a treasure trove of seemingly lost literature is discovered. The latest find is a collection of stories by Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss. Seuss scholars and collectors have known about these stories for a while, and this fall, Random House will publish them. Here's NPR's Lynn Neary.
Before going any further, let's address the question of whether these stories were ever really lost. Random House children's book publisher Kate Klimo says,
no. Shucks, nothing is really ever lost in this day and age.
Maybe scattered would be a better way to describe it. You see, these are not some half-written stories found in a dusty attic after the death of the author. These are stories that have already been published. Dr. Charles Cohen managed to collect them in one place.
They came out in the 50s in magazines, and then when the next month's magazine would come in, people would throw away the old one, and those stories were forgotten. And literally, it's been 60 years or so for some of these stories, and very few people have ever seen them.
A dentist by day, Cohen's real passion is Dr. Seuss. While doing research on the children's book author, Cohen began tracking down original copies of the stories. But he needed a way to support his habit.
I would find some of the magazines that these appeared in. I'd purchase it on eBay for $2 or $5 from people who didn't know that they had these Dr. Seuss stories in them, and then I would list them on eBay and explain what they were. So a $5 magazine might bring in $200 or $400, and that was a great markup for me.
A Random House art director who worked on the Dr. Seuss books saw some of these items for sale on eBay and began wondering about them. Kate Klimo says they decided to look up this Seuss-obsessed dentist in Massachusetts.
We took a field trip up there to his house and discovered that he not only had magazines, but he had beer trays and stuffed animals and figurines and all kinds of stuff. And his knowledge about it was encyclopedic.
Random House commissioned Cohen to write his own book about Dr. Seuss, and that sidetracked them from publishing the stories. Until now.
This is Dr. Seuss before his name is synonymous with children's literature. This is Dr. Seuss before we knew him well.
Philip Nell is a children's literature professor at Kansas State University. He says the new book, The Bipolo Seed and Other Lost Stories, includes 7 stories, some stronger than others, but all equally fascinating.
Even the slight stories are interesting. You know, it's like finding a bunch of lost one-act plays by Shakespeare. They may be minor works, but they're the minor works of a genius, so they're still interesting.
In these stories, says Nell, you see themes and character traits that will become more fully realized in later works. And, he says, you can hear the unmistakable rhymes that are so characteristic of the best-known Dr. Seuss books.
Then it sank in the river and drifted away. And that cat and that duck all the rest of the day dive deep in that river, but never did see a trace of the seed of the bipolo tree.
Charles Cohen is thrilled that these stories will finally be available to the public. He has only one regret.
That's the one thing that was disappointing, is to have read all of these stories, enjoyed all of them, and discovered that these are as good as the things that people already know about. But then thinking, but have I done it all? Am I not going to be able to find any new Seuss stories?
If they're out there, chances are Cohen will find them. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The cable network HBO has built its reputation on developing original shows.
It's earned praise for the way the programs feel true to real life, whether it's the Old West in Deadwood, New York single life in Sex and the City, or recovering New Orleans in Tremé. But as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, HBO begins a series this Sunday based on a best-selling fantasy book.
Some people describe Game of Thrones as The Sopranos meets Middle Earth.
I, Eddard, the House Stark, Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North, sentence you to die.
The Lord of Winterfell heads up one of several powerful families fighting to control a kingdom, which makes Game of Thrones fit the HBO template perfectly, says show co-creator David Benioff.
It's about families in conflict. It's about people trying to gain power. It's about people who are in power trying to keep it.
Still, he says, a high epic fantasy was not the easiest pitch.
Initially, I think there was a degree of skepticism and nervousness because it didn't seem like an HBO show.
It helped that Game of Thrones magic is minimal.
It's not about wizards throwing fireballs and a million orcs fighting a million elves.
That said, creepy supernatural forces are definitely afoot.
Is it Trace or the White Walkers?
White Walkers have been gone for thousands of years.
So he was lying.
The madman sees what he sees.
Game of Thrones is based on the first of a 4,000-page series of books by George R.R. Martin. Yes, that's two R's. He used to work in television. He wrote for The Twilight Zone in the 80s and Beauty and the Beast. But Martin felt limited by television's tight budgets and shooting schedules.
But I'm writing books, and in books you have an unlimited budget. And you can have a cast of thousands. You can have the most magnificent sets and castles. You can have, you know, battles in which millions of people are fighting.
So it's an irony that the books Martin created specifically as something he could never get on TV have been brought to the small screen by other people. People who say his TV sensibility actually made his books easy to adapt. Martin says he's made his peace with being, as he put it, a tourist in his own world.
There are times I say, oh, no, it's not quite the way but it's very good the way they're doing it.
George R.R. Martin is an executive producer for Game of Thrones on HBO, and he's written a few scripts for it, too. He says the network was solicitous of his opinions, which makes sense given his book sold over 4 million copies.
So there's an enormous audience out there for fantasy, for sophisticated adult fantasy, I think.
And right now that audience is in the midst of a fantasy drought. There's no Hobbit for the foreseeable future, no great shows that appeal to fantasy fans like Lost, and it's still a few months till the summer buffet of high-end fantasy movies.
It's not reckless what they're doing.
Anthony Kelso, a media studies professor, has written about HBO. He says international rights have been selling fast. Apparently, geeks know no borders. And fantasy fans are known to buy fully loaded DVD packages. Ultimately, Kelso says, this show may be about attracting a new base of subscribers, not high ratings. Unlike traditional television, of course, HBO does not rely on ads.
Their revenue comes from the people who pay.
People perhaps like Thomas Strickland. He's an information architect in Atlanta and a hardcore fan of the books. Exactly the type HBO hopes to lure with Game of Thrones. You see, Strickland does not subscribe to HBO. Not yet.
It's a bit of an investment to purchase access to an entire channel and pay that premium for basically 1 hour of programming per week.
Yet Strickland is considering it. He's been hanging out on the HBO website, poring over every little advance video, from previews to features about costuming.
Padding, fur, not really metal armor. It just has to almost smell.
Waiting patiently for the DVDs is not an option, says Strickland. He and his friends want to start dissecting the show as soon as it airs, so they can compare it to the book they love. And they may have a solution.
It's very specific to our whole group of nerdy, geeky, wonderful friends.
They're talking about everyone chipping in for one HBO subscription.
We'll all get together, we'll have some wine, and we're going to watch the show together. Sorry, HBO.
Of course, the show's success in bringing new subscribers may determine whether Game of Thrones gets a second season. Netta Ulaby, NPR News. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.